joining us right now is Bruce Arnold. You know him and love him as one of the co-founders of Orpheus. And if you're from Boston like I am, you know the song Can't Find the Time, a legendary tune from the 1960s. We're going to talk to him about that and many other things because he's got a brand new album out and it's got a great new version of the song, which you just heard a piece of just now as we came into the interview. Bruce, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much, Mark. I appreciate your interest in my music.
It's nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
You're fading away again.
Fading away.
There we go. Much better. Talk right into the phone.
Okay.
We go. Now, tell us a little bit about, you're from Worcester originally, right?
That's right.
So, you know I'm around here because I actually didn't call it Worcester.
That's right. Yeah, it has, it really does have a national presence as Worcester, W-I-S-T-A. I hear it sort of mentioned as that's the real pronunciation.
Yeah, it's interesting. Now, you and Jack McInnes are both from there, right?
That's right, yeah. Jack lived about maybe 2 miles away from me.
And you guys used to play together as a folk duo called The Villagers.
Right. Jack and I hit it off really right away, and he was in a group, and I was in a group, but we were both very young. He was a couple of years older than I was, but I must have been like maybe 16 or something when I first met him, and I saw them play, and I was very impressed with Jack, and of course, anything you hear him sing on and play on, you know, he always makes it better, and that impressed me, and also his style, the way he looked, the way he acted, his stage presence. That was all what I thought was a really good thing to emulate. So I sort of joined him, and we created this, The Villagers, and we loved a lot of the folk music and have had histories prior to getting together in loving folk music. I was a big Pete Seeger fan and a Joni Mitchell fan. That was actually a little later, but I was also, I liked the Kingston Trio when they came around, and I got to know John Stewart from the Kingston Trio, mm-hmm. So that was really great. But it had a big influence on both of us, and we liked to smooth it out, maybe make it a little bit more refined than we were hearing, and so we both had that same ideal, and so we worked on several traditional folk songs and smoothed them up into our style. And then eventually I began to introduce songs that I was writing, and I was adding more jazz than folk influence, but really a combination of the two. And so we began to do that, and it wasn't too long before, especially after Dylan had shocked the world by going, quote, electric. Mm-hmm. We also could see where drums and bass could add to, especially this new music that I was writing. And so that went from The Villagers, a folk duo, to trying to find a drummer and a bass player, which we did.
And tell us about how you found them and who they were, and because this is all part of the band.
That came about because Jack was, like I said, a couple of years older than me and playing in the folk music scene professionally in Worcester, as professionally as you could be doing in Worcester. You were the folk guys that people wanted to hire for their little events and so on. And so that he had feelers out into the community and knew someone who was actually a sort of all-around good musician, and that was Eric Gullickson. And Eric, Eric and I and Jack hit it off immediately, just immediately liked the way we sounded together. And so Eric was then added, and not only that, but Eric could sing, and he could add the third part and often more than that, really defining some of the vocal things that we were doing. So he was a great addition. And again, he was older than even Jack, and I say that like Jack was an old man, but I was like 16, 17, 18, and Jack was maybe 20, and Eric was 21, and we thought that was really, you were really old, you know, if you were 21, and so again, Eric had a very good temperament and also could remember what we were supposed to do, like where the concerts were and where the how the booking was, and not to forget to leave without the money. And he then began to play that kind of role as we went on, but we needed a drummer. In fact, we had songs that we were auditioning drummers for, one of which was Can't Find the Time, and I went to my favorite drummers first, drummers that I really thought were good, but one reason or another, these guys that I had known for years weren't able to fulfill what we were going to be able to do. We were going to, you know, almost hobo it to New York City and live at the Y or in the car or whatever we had to do. Sometimes we'd just drive home. And to get our new material and our attempt to add ourselves to the rostrum of people who were playing music on the radio and in records those days. And you could actually make inroads. You could go down and talk to people in New York and make appointments, and you could see the A&R men. You can't do that anymore. But we needed a drummer, and shortly before we went to for our New York auditions, we actually went and planning to play live. Harry Sandler, drummer from the Mods, and sort of a guy who also was versatile, could play a lot of different styles of music, and had stage experience. You know, it wasn't afraid to get on stage and add his personality to the mix. And that was Harry for sure. And he, of course, our early recordings, when Orpheus actually began, we used a studio drummer initially, Bernard Purdy, to get a unified sound, the sound that Alan Lorber wanted. So Harry was basically our live drummer, and he carried out that job very well. And we had many comments about how we had a time for a drum solo for Harry, and he often got compliments about how unique it was. And Harry wasn't copying anybody. He was doing some pretty innovative things for us. And so I think the four of us had saw an opportunity to see what we could do, and Harry was able to play. You know, the audition is we play our songs and you try to play along with us, and he did that. So off to New York we went as Orpheus for some auditions.
Now, I know you did incredibly well there because you had a bunch of recording offers, but how was the name Orpheus picked? Who picked it, and how did it get chosen?
It was, you know, we would do a lot of discussing and dreaming and so on these trips to New York, because we couldn't fly, so we drove. And you know what the drive is like today, and you can imagine it was a lot easier back then, but it was still a long haul, 4 hours probably to New York, and we were on two-lane roads a lot of the time. And so we would have these, you know, we knew that, when we get to Connecticut, we go to this particular Howard Johnson's and so on, and it became a routine to go into New York City and ply our wares. And so we, at that point, began to think, well, what are we going to call ourselves, you know? And a lot of things, I think, came that we were thinking about. You know, we didn't want to be named after a bug or a beetle or, whatever. We wanted to have some name that we also felt was going to showcase our, hopefully our more upscale kind of approach to the way we were going to do some music. And that then produced us thinking really, pretty in the high art kind of thing. And one of the things we were talking about was historical names that we could use. And I believe it came about like this. I believe we were driving out of New York City, and one of the last parts of the more populated sections, there was a theater there, and it was the Orpheum Theater. And we saw that name, and I don't know if it was, all of us saw it at the same time. Probably did, because it was a big neon, movie theater marquee. And we said, I think just looking at each other, we said Orpheum, And I remember that when I went to school, our school was like obsessed with Greek myth, and they would have us do plays and so on. And I remember once I was the brother of Agamemnon, and I had some lines to say that way. But also I was fascinated by the myth of Orpheus. And so seeing the word Orpheum made me think Orpheus and remembering him as this musician of old, who renowned of old. And so I think right then, within just a few minutes of this, you know, inspiration of the Theater Marquee, I think we had pretty much decided that Orpheus would be a great name for the band. But then we reminded ourselves that wasn't up to us. That, you know, you never know what was going to happen when you got into a contract. You know, we're going to say that's our name and that's the name we like. And did we play as Orpheus before we recorded? I don't think so. I don't think we ever. Eric can tell you that. He's more the archivist on those kind of things. But I don't recall that we were Orpheus in any way, in any presence, before we went to New York City and got the recording contract. So we suggested, I remember talking to the fellows who were in charge, Alan Lorber and some of his aides and so on, and we said, well, we want to be called Orpheus. And he said, Orpheus, you know, and he said, well, you know, that's not bad, but we had some ideas ourselves, you know, and we probably will have ideas. In fact, this is what we're doing right now, is what the cover's going to look like and all this stuff. And so I put my vote in again. Well, I really like Orpheus, you know. I think that'd be a great name. Mm-hmm. Little did I realize it actually wasn't a good name in a lot of ways, because it was not really pronounceable by the way it looked. And people would call us all sorts of things except Orpheus. So, but it gave us this... I think this more of a an art appeal, and so I was for it. And lo and behold, a few days later, Alan called me and he said, "Yeah, we're going to go with Orpheus." So we were really pleased with that, and that's how that happened.
So Alan Lorber led you guys down to you guys recorded the album. It came out in the fall of '67, but it was officially released at the Bitter End in Greenwich Village in February of '68.
That's right.
And I know you guys, right after that, opened for Cream at Brandeis. What was that like?
Well, that was quite a situation, because Cream, through no fault of their own, but that wasn't the skinny going around at the time, but Cream was late. Late because they were, I believe, coming in from overseas. Now, they might have been, you know, in Washington or somewhere else, but still... You know, these things aren't up to you sometimes. The plane doesn't fly or whatever the case may be. And so these guys were late, and they were going to be late. And interestingly enough, there was not only the crowd inside, there was also a crowd outside, which was often the case where it was overflow. Mm-hmm. But the people just hung around outside, and more than once they were like, more people outside. There were 1,000 people outside and, you know, 600 people inside. And this was one of those occasions. And Cream had, you know, everybody knew the Yardbirds and so on and so forth, but no one was really into individual people's names in these bands over here. And so Eric Clapton, you know, he wasn't God yet, and he was going to have to prove himself like anybody else. And was it their first tour? It might very well have been their first U.S. tour. And so they were going to be the headliner, because I think they had just had their first big hit, which I can't remember the name of right now, but they got some real good airplay before they came over.
I think it might have been Sunshine of Your Love, wasn't it?
Pardon me?
Was it Sunshine of Your Love that
had
come out?
Yeah, Sunshine of Your Life. That had come out with a smash, and, you know, people were already seeing how great they were. And so, but they were late, and... Suddenly, the guy comes to us who's running the show, and he said, "Would you guys play again?" So, you know, we had developed a set that we played, mm-hmm. and we didn't improvise. And the reason was because it turned out that all of us musicians could play what we were, you know, what was required. But if you said to anybody, you know, you go wild on this and do something, nobody wanted to try to do that because the music was complex enough as it was, mm-hmm. and it took all of our technical ability to play what we were playing anyway. So there wasn't going to be a lot of, yeah, well, I'll tell you what, we'll just improvise for an hour and just jam, you know. We didn't jam. We had these very set performances that were like little crisp little pictures that mm-hmm. Have a beginning and an end, and they lasted about 3 minutes, you know. 3 minutes was about the length of a pop song back
right.
then. And so I said, well, I tell you what, I will do the same set over again. And, you know, many bands did two sets, or sometimes three sets, but many bands did 2 one-hour sets. That's what most bands were doing back then.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I didn't like that idea either, and I'm not sure why, except other than I wanted to go home and I didn't want to hang around very much. And so if we could get our stuff over in one fell swoop, I'd be happy with that. So we only offered ourselves as a 70-minute set. You just get us for 70 minutes and then we go home.
Mm-hmm.
And that we had established that. And so we had one 70-minute set and I said, we can do that same set over again. The guy went out to the audience who was waiting there and they said, hey, you want to hear Orpheus do their set over again? And everybody went, yeah. So we came out and did the set over again. And then they were still late. I think they actually got in at midnight.
Wow.
And the crowd was still all there when they got there.
And Cream, of course, Sunshine of Your Love and White Room and everything, I'm sure they transfixed the crowd.
It was amazing. And, of course, this is when you see what it's all about with somebody like Eric Clapton. And to see also, you know, we thought, yeah, we can coordinate together. But these guys were really, you know, they're on the top of the heap. There was
right.
no question about it. And the juxtaposition of our stuff with their stuff was, many times we would open for a lot of these bands, and it was sometimes a strange juxtaposition. It was it was us doing our sort of classically oriented jazz pop, and then those guys doing their over the top take as much of the drugs as you can before you get on stage. We also sort of did that part too, but it wasn't as clear in the music that's what was happening.
So here you guys are touring. Your record is out, and around here, and I grew up in Randolph, in the Boston area. Can't Find the Time was a massive, massive hit around this area. I always thought it was a big national hit, but it only hit number 80 on the top 100.
Isn't
but
that's funny. Isn't
I understand why though, because it's been explained to me a number of times that MGM really only did regions rather than the whole country, and they had to re-release it over and over again in different areas, and they never did it right.
Well, beyond that, though, here's how we found out that we were going to have problems with MGM. We'd gone to Detroit, which is, was that as far west as we get? Then we went to Chicago, which is further west, Chicago or Detroit? I think Chicago's further west. But
mm-hmm.
anyway, we're in Detroit, and we were to do a gig at some club there, which you know, where bands like us who had songs on the charts. We had Can't Find the Time was really big in Detroit, and it was really big in Chicago. But very briefly, and here's why: we got to Detroit, and they said, "Oh man, this is great. The radio stations want to talk to you." And we said, "Okay." So we had a gig that night, and we were going to get down and do our radio interview that afternoon. Nothing could be better. We get down there, and the program director says to us, "I'm going to put you on the air, but I just want to tell you, I don't like what's going on." And what? What's going on? Well, we don't play music that you can't buy locally, and you can't. You know, you've released your record, but no one can get down and buy it. So everything we play depends upon the input from the people who sell them, so we know what to play. And the input from them is they don't even have your record. And we said, what do you mean? What are you talking about? So we called the manager, and the manager said this: MGM's on the verge of bankruptcy. They have not paid their creditors, which are these people who are... they're working with to make press the albums and get them distributed out. So they're not paying to get these albums pressed, and the pressing company's going, well, we're not going to put anything out. What do you think we're going to do? We're going to make somebody else's record. So that's what happened. And then from that point on, the MGM project was crashing to the ground. No matter what we did, anybody did. It wasn't known from outside so much, but we saw it happening, that it was mismanaged. It had begun to fall apart. The money, the cash flow was not there anymore. They spent $250,000. Yes, they actually did do that for the Boston Sound promotion, but they flubbed the delivery of the album. So, everybody's looking at the Lenny Scher, the president of MGM, and saying, well, listen, you made us spend $250,000 to promote this in Detroit, but you didn't put any product there.
Mm.
There's the story.
Wow. Well, so they really messed up big, because that song would have been a huge national hit and could have changed everything for you.
Well, you know what? It was a national hit. You know, I followed it as all it was happening, especially with BMI, which is airplay royalties, mm-hmm. right? So I knew exactly what was happening with the song, and here's what was happening. It was becoming number one in virtually every region in which it played. It was number one in Bakersfield, California. It was number one in Honolulu, Hawaii. Number one, I mean to tell you, okay? It was number one, strong number one for a couple of weeks. Any place that happened, it became a number one, but it never happened at the same time.
Yeah.
It happened in November in Boston, or, well, like you say, whenever it came out, or next February in Boston. Well, it was number one, of course, in Boston, and everybody was going crazy, and New York. That area all got it saturated with it, and that was great. But nobody in the Southwest heard the song at all, except eventually out in the real Southwest in Bakersfield, California, somebody's got it on the jukeboxes, and they love it, and it's going crazy all by itself without any promotion. But there's the, there's the whole object of doing this, is that these middlemen, who granted have all the resources, and we have virtually only an unknown quantity, but if they don't know what they're doing, or if they get accused of hype like what they did with the Boston Sound, that they could have fixed the Boston Sound thing if they had thought about it by just adding an S, the Boston Sounds. Had they said that, there would have been no implication that we sounded like Motown or anything else. It would have just, or a specific thing like mm-hmm. Motown.
Right.
But it would have just been an expose of all the great music in the area. And but that kind of thing cost. But you know what? I must tell you, Mark, that I'm glad that there was not some sort of Orpheus mania thing happening over that song, and that my life would be turned upside down. I enjoy being able to practice my art unobserved, influenced by things that I don't want to be influenced by. I only, I'm inspired by the things I immerse myself in, not the things that I've been immersed in by somebody else. So I don't look back at that and go, oh, Jesus, too bad that I wanted my health, I wanted wealth, but I didn't, there was no, I wasn't crazy about it, but I wanted those things. And I couldn't see getting those things in that crazy business. I really couldn't.
Now, for some folks out there who are listening, who aren't as old as I am, many of the folks out there have heard this song for the first time by Hootie and the Blowfish in the Jim Carrey movie, Me, Myself, and Irene.
Yes.
So that must have given a little bit of a pump to your version as well.
They do indeed. They are, when I was sent a copy of it, I couldn't have been more pleased. I love their version of the song. It's just great. And Darius, oh my gosh, I was so pleased. And, little did I know that was actually being recorded in April of the previous year at the record plant in Sausalito. And I was just a few miles away. And no one had, ever put the two and two together, or, I would have certainly been wanting to hear them record it and so on. But little did I know that was being done. And then suddenly I find out it's going to be in a movie, which, was the huge pleasant surprise, and then just to be shocked that it was going to be Hootie and the Blowfish doing it. And then when I got the their version of it, I was just so pleased. And then that began a great relationship with the band. And, you know, I toured the West Coast with them, and we would, Darius and I would sing Can't Find the Time, and he would do the first verse, and I would do the second verse, and we would sing the ba-da-da-da-das together. And it was a fabulous time. And I want to tell you, that's a very tight band. You know, that is a college bar band, and they are about as tight as you can imagine. And the guys have been playing together for 10 years, and they knew exactly what to do, and they had a great version of the song. I would just come out, and they would hand me a guitar. Fortunately, it was in G, and they pretty much followed the song chords and key changes as they were. A lot of people don't know about the key changes, but they did a great job on that, and so I was able to play their version of it on stage. And we played, some stuff in Reno, and we did the House of Blues in L.A., and we did this huge Father's Day thing at Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, and we did the Fillmore together, and it was extraordinary. And the greatest thing of all was that Darius told me how great he thought our version of the song was, and that he just said, "I love the way you sing that second verse," you know. And it was rewarding. And I tell you, I wish I had brought my camera, my video camera, because some of the backstage things that were going on there were so great. And when we would sort of go over Can't Find the Time backstage to, you know, make everybody get back in the groove of it and so on, I would have loved to record those things, because they were just precious to see. There were six or eight of us up there, we're all singing Can't Find the Time in backstage, and it was just really great. But they were so generous. Darius is such a generous person. He literally told me, he said, "How are you doing?" You know, and I said, "No, I'm doing just fine." And then he turned to his aide and he said, "Nah, Bruce is doing okay." He said, "So don't, you know, we don't have to worry about it." As though, hey, do you need something? Whatever you need, you know, what do you need? But that's the way they are, and they're all like that. Bass player and Mark, and gosh, they're all just really, really great guys.
Now, "Can't Find the Time" is a very popular song, and there's been at least half a dozen cover versions of it. I remember one by Rose Colored Glass, which actually was on the charts in 71.
That's right.
So this is good for you as the songwriter.
Oh, definitely is. And as BMI was telling me, that we've just passed a 500,000 airplay on "Can't Find the Time." And, you know, that's pretty darn good for a 40-year-old song. And the other thing about the Blowfish, I mean, you know, think about it. If in 1967, when I was doing it, I went back 40 years to find a song to redo, I would be doing "If You Knew Susie Like I Knew Susie" or something. It just would not be compatible.
That's
but
true.
It's really saying something about, you know, the timelessness of what that song was, what we were trying to say and do in that song, that someone could do it 40 years later. Almost like another song I love so much is "It's All in the Game," you know, the huge Tommy Edwards hit.
Sure,
and
yeah.
I also have a version of that that's a bonus track. If you get a hold of us, if you buy the CD, you get this bonus track of that song. But that is 100 years old, and it was originally done by the man who was actually the vice president under Calvin Coolidge. And the music was written, and then it was updated when Tommy Edwards did it lyrically. And now I've done it again. But, you know, there are some songs you can bring forward like that.
Now, we're talking about "Orpheus Again" right, by Bruce Arnold. It's a new CD, and people can get that at CD Baby, right?
CD Baby or Amazon.com or, Dustberry, or just Google it. It'll come up in several places. The cheapest is CD Baby. Some are expensive. They're also on eBay. There are some autographed copies that I did for a nonprofit.
Now,
so they're all over the place. If you just Google Bruce and Orpheus Again, you'll find everything.
We're going to put a link to your Facebook page.
Right. Yes.
But you don't have a website, though, huh?
No. You know, I like Facebook because you really do speak with everybody who are your fans, and you know why they're your fans, and they there's an interaction with people that, you know, I had hoped the music would have, and it's not something I could do with millions of people, but on a Facebook size kind of a thing, you can have some developing relationships with the people who have liked your music. Either, you know, you're right. I get a lot of people who say, I love Can't Find the Time by Hootie and the Blowfish. I had no idea that this was such a, you know, a hit years and years ago. And, you know, I want to know all about Orpheus now. And it's really created quite a renaissance for the first albums.
For folks out there who want to order it, actually, you can go right to cdbaby.com/CD/Bruce A. And that'll get you right to the CD. Let me ask you about some of the people you guys toured with, because we mentioned Cream.
Right.
But didn't you actually play with Janis Joplin, Led Zeppelin, and The Who?
Yes. Well, The Who was one of our... that was memorable. Well, they were all memorable. Janis Joplin was tremendous. We did Tanglewood, I think, with her. That was just incredible to see her and to see that band work together and to see how much alcohol she had drunk before that performance. That was extraordinary. Southern
Comfort, yeah. That was her thing.
Hold on just a second. Yeah, yes, that was extraordinary. And Led Zeppelin was extraordinary. I remember that being so loud that we could hear it better in the dressing room than you could in the room. But The Who was just a great experience because of Roger Daltrey and Entwistle, because they were great guys. We turned out we were both playing that night in Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. That was the first night we played together, and we were on the bill together, and I'm not even sure I think they were top billing, but we had really good billing there, and it was just going to be the two of our bands playing. And it happened to be the night that Lyndon Johnson, the president, announced that he was not going to run again, which was very good news to the people in the audience. And it was so great because it was announced just before we came on, and so to this huge screaming and yelling that he had, and now here's Orpheus, and so it was a, you know, it was a heady moment there. In any case, we did get to know all of the band, and Keith Moon and you know, Pete Townsend, and greatest experience we had was when we realized that we were both going to be performing next at the Schaefer Music Festival in Central Park, and then we were going to also be the same thing either the same night or maybe the night after in some other venue. Roger said, why don't you guys come on the bus with us? And so we did. We all jumped on the bus after Constitution Hall, and except Pete flew. He flew everywhere, but Entwistle and Daltrey and Moon, and we had a great ride from, this was after the show, you know, like 3 in the morning,
mm-hmm.
And the bus driver pretended he didn't smell anything, or, you know, he just, we just had a wonderful time, and all the way up to New York, and then the next day we both did play at the Schaefer Music Festival, And so anyway, we had a great time of bonding with those guys. And Entwistle changed our sound because we kept listening to these bass notes that he was hitting, and it was, wow, what the heck is that? It sounded like it's a Mack truck coming at you. And turned out that he had piano strings remanufactured or was able to find them this way that he could put on his bass. You know, up until that time, most basses had what was called flat wound strings. And they were very smooth. They sounded like an upright bass. They were trying to mimic an upright bass.
Mm-hmm.
Well, once you put these round wound strings on that go twang, twang, bang, bang, as well as the note, you have got yourself a machine. And I believe that he gave a set to Eric Gullickson, our bass player, on the bus that night. And we used them from then on, and it added so much to our sound. We were so appreciative of that.
Now, on that same time, you guys also provided the song, I think it was called Little Sister for Marlo with James
right.
Garner.
Right.
Was that the first time that you guys were in a film?
Well, we actually weren't in the film.
No, I mean the songs. It was your songs.
It was the theme song. And yes, it was. There was a time when we would go to New York to record, and then we would tour and all other places. But every time we got to New York, quite possibly that was done when we were recording the second album, which was a very busy time. You know, we had a long time to do the first album. We had a luxurious amount of time where we could, you know, listen and decide whether this was good or bad and so on and so forth. But the second album, that was different. We were on tour and we got the call, okay, you're coming in to do the second album. You got 2 weeks, you know, and oh, God, 2 weeks. So in we go and we do that. But we also then had other things. And I remember not only Little Sister in Marlow, but we also did an RCA commercial, for televisions or something. And I remember it went, ba-ba-ba, the RCA way. And there are a couple of other things we did like that. So, yeah, hopefully that's a part of a band's future, that you get to do those kinds of things. And we did have our chance to do some.
We've almost run out of time here, so I want to kind of, you know, Ascending came out and was a winner of one of Playboy magazine's 69 Jazz and Pop poll as Vocal Album of the Year, one of the winners. Joyful had that single Brown Arms in Houston that peaked in the top 100 as well. But let's skip ahead, because I have in my hand the Orpheus Again album, and one of the people that's on it, I was kind of surprised to see, is a veteran of this show. He's been on a couple times, and unfortunately he's not with us anymore, Brad Delp. Yes. How did you get Brad on the CD?
Well, Brad was a teenager in the audience when Orpheus was playing around, and made himself known to my brother, Lester, and Lester said, hey, you know, Brad Delp, and in Boston, of course, was
huge
several years after Orpheus, and just when Boston was beginning to break, he said, you know, this guy from Boston, Brad Delp, really likes your music, and next time you come back, you know, we should get together and so on. So I said, hey, great. So we did, and we got back together, and Brad and I hit it off immediately, and then when he said to me, you know, Bruce, it's always been one of my dreams to sing with Orpheus, I could not be quicker to oblige. Absolutely. And so we were recording, and so I said, we're recording at Blue Jay up in New Hampshire. And, you know, as you please, if you want to come up and help. In fact, I said, I'm also, we're prepared to do the Boston Music Awards live. And, you know, if you would like to, you could, you know, be the part of the harmony, and I think he played the tambourine, and he said, great. So we basically went up and recorded what we did that night at the Boston Music Awards, and that's what's one of the two of the things on the CD.
Very cool. That's a very cool thing. I want to go out with one other thing I thought was very interesting. There was a story going around that Chevy Chase, under the tutelage of your former producer, Alan Lorber, was actually touring as Orpheus. Was there any truth to that?
Yes, that's absolutely true. And in fact, it was confirmed to us by Chevy Chase, and confirmed that Alan Lorber was the person doing that. And we also knew it was happening because we got a newsletter from some hippie thing, a flyer from out in San Francisco, and Orpheus was playing. And you know, Elliot Sherman, my friend, said, you know, that's you guys. And I said, no, it's not. It's not us. He said, I think that is a fake Orpheus. I said, no, it's not. And he said, well, I'm going to call him. So that night when it was time to play, I was there. And Elliot called and he said, Orpheus, you guys from Boston? Yes. Oh, well, you guys, now you're the guys who sing Can't Find the Time, right? Yes, we are. And so he said, you know, I know, he said something like, no, you're not. You know, I'm talking to the guy right now standing next to me who's in the band. And we hung up, but we knew something was fishy. And then Chevy said it in a Boston Globe article, and he was the one who first brought it up, that he said that he was out there, and he had my part. He was singing my part, and people would yell, you're not Orpheus. And then they'd go, yeah, we are. And there'd be a big argument on, you know, between the audience. So, yeah, that was, they tell me, that was commonplace, you know, to be able to, because after all, it wasn't us guys that they were making money off of. It was this Orpheus concept, and if they could make other people believe, you know, that anybody was Orpheus, then why not? It's their project. It's their property.
Well, for folks around the country who are listening right now, Are there any official Orpheus tours planned? Are you going to be anywhere we should know about?
Well, I am planning to come back to Boston, and two things I would like to do. One, I'm speaking right now with Berklee College of Music, Tiger Okoshi, who is on that CD at Orpheus again. Fabulous, fabulous musician. And he and I've talked to Bernard Purdy, who's the drummer from the band, and Howie Hirsch, and we all are going to come back and do a concert in Boston, probably in the auditorium at the Berklee College of Music. But what I really want to do is a free concert on Boston Commons like we did back in 1968. And I want to see if I can coordinate that at around the same time so we can have a little concert that we do in an audience with, you know, in a nice theater and then do a big free concert. So, yeah, we're hoping to do that. Am I going to do a tour? No, I don't think so. But I do think we'll play around occasionally and try to, you know, we're... Orpheus again has created quite a bit of stir and interest, and so I have a feeling we will be back and doing something.
Well, let us know, because we want to spread the word out here, Mark, if you're going to tour.
I'm really appreciative of your call, and thank you very much.
It's great to talk to you, and keep up the music.
Okay, thanks.
Take care.